And hello and a big welcome to a Juno Afternoon. My name is Jamie Waste. I'll be your host for today's program. Following National Native News, we'll be talking with Lena Simmons and John Clow about the 40th anniversary of Juno Lyric Opera. Kristen Price will update us on a gospel singing workshop that's coming to Juno. Dr. Kathy Steppen will be here to talk about pediatric health concerns. Darren Snyder will be here to highlight this Saturday's community garden tour. And we'll speak with Seneca Harper about the upcoming performances of Maud Carousel. That, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, Music, and more up next on a Juno Afternoon on KTOO News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Testimony was heard Tuesday on South Dakota Representative Kristi Noem's Indian Health Service bill to create tribal lead boards that control IHS hospitals. The Congresswoman says the boards will improve retention, reduce wait times, and update the services funding formula. Lee Strubinger reports.
Congresswoman Kristi Noem says her bill seeks to change the culture within the Indian Health Service. Noem says the IHS must retain quality employees, but she says agency personnel also need to be held accountable. However, the head of IHS, Mary Smith, testified before the House subcommittee that it's hard to fill positions.
We have very serious recruitment and retention problems. We have lots of vacancies. And I can tell you that personally, I am committed to quality health care in the Great Plains. I spend a lot of time working on that. I know we don't move as fast as people would like.
Smith has been the head of IHS for 3 months. Representative Noem says her bill opens the door for tribal self-governance of health care, but she says Great Plains tribes aren't quite able to pull that off yet. The tribal members who testified at the hearing say they support Noem's legislation, but some critics say the IHS needs more funding overall. For National Native News, I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Construction is beginning on a Native Children's Dental Clinic and Health Services facility in Anchorage, Alaska. As KNBA's Jocelyn Estes reports, officials say it will help boost services to the more than 100,000 people who access Indian Health Services.
At a groundbreaking ceremony in Anchorage on Monday, South Central Foundation President and CEO Catherine Gottlieb said the new clinic will add 32 dental chairs to the 15 they have now and provide a space tailored for children. She says the new building will bring together other children's services programs as well.
Well, including that dental clinic building, it'll be 5 stories, OBGYN, behavioral health for children, and also a few other specialties for children that have developmental needs.
As a tribal entity, South Central Foundation can and does bill Medicare, Medicaid, and private insurance companies for services. It'll tap those revenues to fund construction. Gottlieb says the total price tag for the building is still being negotiated. The project is due for completion in 2018. I'm Jocelyn Estes.
At the Assembly of First Nations gathering Tuesday in Ontario, the head of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police expressed the need for a partnership with the country's First People. Dan Karpinchuk has more on what this means for First Nations communities.
Last year, during an AFN meeting in Quebec, RCMP Commissioner Bob Paulson was asked about racism within his force. At the time, Paulson acknowledged there were racists on the force and he didn't want them there. Now he's going further.
I'm here today to pledge that we will put action to these words, so we can continue the healing, continue the building, and improve these vital relationships in every way possible.
The new protocol was developed jointly with First Nations to ensure that Indigenous people in Canada are safe, their diverse needs are met, and mutual respect is strengthened. The Mounties, as they're called, have long been the object of scorn and criticism from Canada's Aboriginal people. The Chiefs invited Paulson back to this meeting to talk about how to tackle misconceptions. For his part, the National Chief of the AFN, Perry Bellegarde, acknowledged that there will always be issues that play out with police at all levels across the country. The question of racism and bias within police agencies will likely be an issue during the long-awaited inquiry into missing and murdered Aboriginal women and girls. The mandate for that inquiry is expected to be clarified this summer, but a specific date has yet to be announced. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. And by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C.
Support by the National Museum of the American Indian, presenting the 2016 Native Cinema Showcase August 16th to the 21st in Santa Fe, New Mexico. The Week of Indian Market. Information at americanindian.si.edu.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And a big welcome into the studio to John Clow and Lena Simmons, who are both board members with Juno Lyric Opera, and I believe longtime participants in operas and singing the music community at large, the vocal music community here in the capital city for many years. So welcome to you both.
Thanks. Good to see you, Jamie.
And I know that you guys have had an incredible 40th anniversary year. You've been in the studio over the course of the year talking about different events that you've produced in honor of 40 years of community service. And you have the big gala kind of finale event of the anniversary year coming up. So why don't you tell folks about what's on the schedule?
Well, this has been, of course, our 40th anniversary year, and it's been without doubt the most ambitious schedule we've had in the history of Juno Lyric Opera. And the closing event for the whole year is our gala, which is on July 29th at 7 p.m., Elizabeth Paratrovich Hall here in downtown. And what we are putting together is it's a fundraising event, but we have brought together some of the finest local singers, some of the finest singers from out of town that ever performed with us, and bringing them all back together and put together a program of sort of greatest hits from Juno Lyric Opera Productions over the last 40 years. So it's going to be the most musically oriented gala event we've ever put on. I think it's going to be like 18 or 20 different performances, and it's really going to be quite special that way.
That's a lot.
That is a lot. I pity the poor. Luke Weld is our pianist, and he's having to learn everything from Bizet to Mozart to Meredith Wilson to, you know, just all over the place. You know, Rodgers and Hammerstein, you know. It's just a variety of musical styles, because over the years we've done opera, and we've done operetta, and we've done Broadway, and we've done major choral works, and they're all going to be represented at the gala.
I would like to think this would have been a fun program to figure out.
It was a hard program.
Or was it torturous?
It was torturous. You sit there and you look at all this stuff and you go, but we have to sing, but we have to do, you know, we have to perform this. And, you know, the first draft probably ended up being like, you know, 22 hours, and, you know, then you start, you know, whittling it down, you know, to what you absolutely want to do and have to do, and still don't include everything we want to do and have to do. But, you know, it's going to be a little over 2 hours of pretty good music.
So in addition to the music, usually you guys have some other things going on or things of interest for people who who show up.
It's going to be, we're going to have complimentary tapas for everybody there. There'll be an open bar. We're going to have some great dessert auctions of cupcakes that are being specially sort of themed for some of our shows in the past. Steve Allwine's going to be our auctioneer again. We've got, you know, half a dozen or so really nice items to auction off, leading off with a very, very fancy cruise for two from the Uncruise Adventures folks. And they're going to be sort of springing all the details about that at the night of the event. But really quite a high-end cruise. We're going to have some local flight tours, things like that. So a nice mix of stuff. And surrounded by this really amazing program of music.
Lena, you've already mentioned some of the artists that are being featured. I mean, can you give a little bit of a preview for people who are thinking of coming?
Sure.
What they might hear, what they might see?
Our own diva, Kathleen Wayne, is going to reprise Guider and Bigay from Candide. And Jay Query will sing from Tosca. And we're going to have Mark Krantz, who's coming up, who has been up before, is going to reprise his role as Alfredo from La Traviata and as the Beast from Beauty and the Beast. And it's going to be, you know, music from Mikado and music from, you know, Cinderella. And, you know, so it's and we're going to do some Brahms for the chorus and 76 trombones and, you know, and as many people as we could find who could reprise their roles. We're going to start off with Patricia Hall singing the pants part from De Fledermaus, which was the very first opera Juno Lyric Opera ever did. And it's the invitation song where Prince Orlovsky says, come to my party and drink, you know. And so we were asking you to come to our party and drink, you know, and have a good time.
What's kind of really nice is this is a very, very eclectic program because
we've been
a very eclectic organization for about four decades now. Mm-hmm. So literally there's going to be, you know, little fun songs. Rita's Confession, if you've ever seen Cheryl Crawford when she won the Who's Your Diva competition in front of her a few years ago, she has this hysterical song called Rita's Confession. We've got some of the most famous opera arias in history being performed for us. And, you know, we're going to finish off hopefully with a couple of the big choral numbers from some of our Broadway things. So there's going to be something in there for everybody, and just we've got just an amazing group of singers have volunteered to work with us, and it's really, really top end.
Now, how do you, not everybody's here right now, right? And you're not necessarily, do you have a rehearsal?
We're rehearsing.
You are?
We are rehearsing.
So everybody who is in town is already
is rehearsing. They better be.
Well, the trickiest part is getting the chorus together to rehearse.
Yeah, I guess that's probably what I'm asking. I realize people are rehearsing on their own, but at some point do you actually pull everybody together in the space and say, we're going to do a walkthrough?
Sort of, you know, as best we can, you know, these sorts of things just sort of, you know.
They have a flow of their own.
And those of you that know us know that for the past 28 years now, Dr. Byron McGilvery, one of the leading choral directors in all the United States, has been coming up and doing workshops with us, and he has come up for this, so he's working with our chorus for this. So, like I said, this is going to be pretty high-class stuff.
So and I want to make sure there's a little bit of time for people who really don't know much about the organization. When you're celebrating 40 years, it's pretty remarkable. But before we kind of move on to that, anything else about, I mean, let's repeat the information about the event itself. And is there anything else about the event you want to make sure people know about?
Well, first of all, there is a price. You have to pay $40 a person to come in. And you can get those tickets at the Jack website. You can get them at our website. You can get them at Hearthside Books, sort of, you know, the usual players in town. Again, it's July 29th at 7 p.m. at the Elizabeth Perotrovich Hall, the A&B building here downtown. For those of you that haven't been, by the way, been in there to see that room since they've redone it, it is just a lovely venue. It's going to be the first time we've done one of our major events there, and we're quite excited about that. So those are the basics, the when, where, and how, and we really encourage people to buy up the tickets because we have been getting some pretty good ticket sales, and we want to fill the place up. And come prepared. Just enjoy a great evening. There is a no-host bar, but you do get a meal out of it. You get complimentary tapas. And it's going to be just a really fun night. The people that were there to our galas in the past have always said, hey, that was fun, and that's what we're shooting for.
Lena, anything else just about the event before we kind of touch on just the history of the organization a bit?
Well, just that, you know, there's incredible musical talent in this town, and we're very excited that they want to sing with us. And they're going to be singing that night, so you got to come up and you got to come here. You know?
So 40 years. Congratulations 40 years. To everybody involved with Juno Lyric Opera. That's a whole lot of volunteers and talent for many, many years. So just a brief history on the organization for people who really don't know anything about it.
Well, in 1975, there were three women in town, Gloria Barclay and Karen Hansen and Pam Hutchinson, who were taking voice lessons at the university. And they got it into their head to do a Judy Garland, Mickey Rooney, let's put on a show, you know, use our talent. So they searched around and found Strauss's Die Fledermaus, which has three beautiful roles for their vocal types, you know, and went to First National Bank of Alaska and took out a loan and scrounged in everybody's attics and closets to get costuming and singers and put on a show. And they had such a good time, they were able to pay back their loan from the bank, and they decided, let's do it again, and then let's do it again, and let's do it again. And so for a long time, we did one show a year. Then in the late 80s, a couple of folks in town went up to Fairbanks, which had just started their Fairbanks Fine Arts Festival, and met Byron McGilvery and said, well, would you like to come down to Juno? And he said yes. And so we added the Midwinter Vocal Festival in the late 80s. Then in the early 90s, we added the Midsummer Vocal Festival. And then toward the end of the 90s, we started doing a second production, theater, you know, production every year. And then we added choral groups and things like Holiday Pops. And suddenly it just sort of like bloomed from going from one production in the 70s and 80s to averaging 4 to 5 a year.
And I think what makes Juno Lyric Opera distinctive from a lot of the other arts organizations in town is, first of all, hardly anybody else can say they've been doing this for 40 years nonstop, but we are dedicated to the vocal performing arts. We really are. And there are so many varieties. Sure, people hear Juno Lyric Opera, you think opera, you know, Yeah, we do that, but we also do the fun Broadway plays. We do these wonderful choral workshops. We do training sessions. We do individual recitals. We do sort of, they just did a wonderful program called the Aves out at the Shrine back in May, which was just stunning.
Beautiful.
Wonderful, wonderful women sing these beautiful pieces of music out at the Shrine of St. Teresa. If it involves singing and the vocal performing arts, we like to think that we've been the leading organization in town for many years now. We're real proud about that.
And if people want to get involved, aside from just attending your gala event, if people wanted to get involved with the organization?
Well, we've got a website, which has obviously our email address and our phone number on it. We've got a fantastic executive director, Sarah Radke Brown, who's also singing several of the songs with us on the 29th. So contact Sarah either by email or by telephone, and I guarantee you she'll be happy to hear from you.
We can always use volunteers. I mean, and whether it's backstage, whether it's singing on stage, whether it's doing tech, whether it's taking tickets, whether it's stuffing envelopes. You can always use volunteers, and we love them.
So a big thank you, Lena Simmons and John Clough, for coming in to the studio for this interview and for all the work you do on behalf of this organization. So again, it's the big gala, the final event, 40th anniversary season, Juno Lyric Opera, July 29th at 7 p.m. at the Elizabeth Peratrovich Hall. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 13th of July, 2016. It's the birthday of the poet John Clare, born in Northamptonshire, England, 1793. He was the son of rural peasants, and his first book of poems was a big success when he was 27. He published it so he could save his parents from eviction. But he never felt comfortable in literary circles in London, and once he became known as a writer, he never felt welcome among the laborers in Northamptonshire either. He wrote, "They hardly dare talk in my company for fear I should mention them in my writings, and I find more pleasure in wandering the fields than in musing among my neighbors." He wound up in a mental institution, wrote some of his best poetry there, and though in person he was obviously insane, there was no trace of it in his poetry. He lived to the ripe old age of 71. It's the anniversary of the New York City blackout, 1977, when lightning hit three substations, shut down the power grid about 9:30 in the evening. The airport shut down, tunnels were closed, the subways stopped, the passengers had to be evacuated. There was a serial killer out who called himself Son of Sam. City was nervous about that. It was in the grip of a brutal heat wave. And in the 25 hours before power was restored, more than 1,600 stores were looted. More than 1,000 fires were set. Nearly 3,800 looters were arrested. It was an ugly day in New York City. Here's a poem for today by Anne Whitehouse. One summer day on the number one train. When the doors of the express opened at 72nd Street, the local was waiting. She entered with me, tall and angular as a crane, her expression alert, violin poised against her clavicle like a wing. The train was half empty, the passengers dozing or absorbed in their smartphones. She stood at one end of the car, her gaze swiftly appraising us while the doors slid shut. Closing her eyes, she lifted her bow and dipped her chin, and into that pause went all the years of preparation that had brought her to this moment. The train accelerated in a rush of cacophony, her music welled up, and I recognized a Bach concerto blossoming to fullness like an ever-opening rose. Suddenly, I was crying for no reason and every reason in front of strangers. I thought of the courtroom where an hour ago I'd sat listening to testimony with fellow jurors charged to determine the facts and follow the law. But no matter how we tried, we couldn't reverse damage or undo wrong. The music was contrast and balm, like sunlight in subterranean air. The tears wet on my cheeks, I broke into applause, joined by fellow passengers. We'd become an audience, her audience, just before the doors opened and we scattered. Making my offering, I exited, too shy to catch her eye, but she'd seen the effect her music had wrought. Its echo resounded in my memory, following me into the glory of the summer afternoon. It is with me still. A poem by Ann Whitehouse, One Summer Day on the Number One Train, used by permission of the poet here on The Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, a monthly devoted to discovering and publishing new voices in poetry. More at poetryfoundation.org. And by Progressive Insurance, working to make progress for more than 75 years. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support comes from the Alaska Robotics Gallery, offering art that features narwhals, squid, and flying whales, located at 220 Front Street in downtown Juneau. More information at alaskarobotics.com.
And I'd like to welcome Kristen Price into the studio on a Juneau afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you.
And you're involved with something that sounds just like a whole lot of fun to me. I mean, we just heard from Juneau Lyric Opera, mm-hmm. so we're thinking about singing. And mm-hmm. you just, before the mics were turned on, you said how good for the soul singing is. I think that's what you said.
It is.
Yeah.
Good for the soul.
So you're involved with an upcoming workshop, a gospel singing workshop, coming
that's right.
here, or coming to the capital city. So why don't you tell people about this upcoming event?
Absolutely. So it's a community gospel choir. It's open choir, no auditions. All ages, all abilities. Young kids, middle school, and younger need to have an adult or a parent. We have a guest conductor named Dr. Stephen Newby. He's the director of the Center for Worship at Seattle Pacific University. And he's going to come up and coach us and direct us for a couple of nights and learning some really fun songs. Some of them are his own compositions. A variety of styles, gospel, and then we're going to put on a concert on and at the culmination of that, and it's going to be really fun, a free concert.
So if people are interested and they get involved, so they have a couple of nights, a couple of evenings where
mm-hmm.
they're going to, like, be handed the material and it's like,
sure.
let's go. I mean, that's the way it's going to work, and by the time the performance rolls around, you guys will be ready to sing.
That's right, yep.
Have you done this before?
No.
Exciting. But you've participated in gospel singing before.
Mm-hmm.
And
sure.
And but this is the first time that you've actually been kind of responsible or organizing this
right.
kind of an event.
Right.
Yeah. So what's all involved? How did you figure out who to ask to do this? And
well, I ran into Stephen Newby at in Seattle back in February, and it's just dynamite. And I was at a conference and I saw him do his thing, and I thought, oh my goodness. And I just kind of gathered up my courage and said, hey, would you like to come to Alaska? And he was like, sure. So invited him and found a time that he was available. And
so how many people do you need for the workshop? How many people do you need for this to work?
Oh, well, that's a good question. We're just whoever wants to be there. I mean, it would be nice to have 30, 40 people in the choir.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see what happens.
And there's been, we were talking earlier, there's been some other gospel workshops here in the capital city, and it sounds like the turnouts have been huge. There's a big singing community here in the capital city, mm-hmm. and that, so the odds are pretty good you could attract 30 or 40 people for this.
I hope so, yeah.
Yeah, right.
I know that we love to sing, and there's, you know, people are busy in the summer, but this kind of thing is so much fun, yeah.
And what is it about gospel music? I mean, there's a lot of different styles of music and singing. What is it about gospel?
Well, you know, it just kind of actually, the idea is a diversity of music. And so it doesn't always have to fit in a category of music. And gospel music is, you know, is surely a soulful kind of music. But, you know, other styles are equally creative, and I think that he's going to touch on that idea that other styles are wonderful too.
And in terms of experience level, you mentioned all ages.
Mm-hmm. You don't have to read music. It'd be nice if, you know, you love to sing. That's kind of key.
That helps.
but no, you don't need to have a lot of experience. He's going to coach us, and the music is easy to learn as mm-hmm. well.
And then the performance itself, is that an hour long? Is it 2 hours? Is it?
We'll probably shoot for a little over an hour. We'll be learning only 5 pieces, and then we'll have some other musicians to fill it out, and have Stephen do some special things too.
Live music? You got a band playing, or is it?
Yes.
It is.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah.
And are you going to be singing? I'm just curious.
I am.
Well, good for you. So, if people are interested, if they haven't already heard about this mm-hmm. or in the pipeline on this, how do they learn more about it? How do they get involved?
You can log on to the Chapel by the Lake website, and there's some information posted there. You could, that is www.chapelbythelake.org. You could give me a call at 957-0099, or you can shoot me an email. If you just want to sign up, you can email me kprice@chapelbythelake.org. And we're just looking kind of to see how many we can get, because we are going to have a dinner for the participants on the Friday evening. So it'd be nice to see how many we'll have to be able to prepare food.
Mm-hmm. So just kind of tell people exactly what it is that you're producing and what you're hoping to see in terms of community response. So just, you know, what is it, date, time,
okay.
How do they get involved?
Okay, so it's a community gospel choir. We're doing rehearsals on July 22nd and 23rd. On Friday the 22nd, we're going to rehearse from 5 to 7, and then we're going to have a meal. And then on Saturday the 23rd, we're going to rehearse from 4:30 to 6:30, and then we're going to have a free concert at 7. So if you're not going to sing, you can come to the free concert.
Mm-hmm. Anything else about the event that you want people to know about?
Well, I think it's just, we just want to have a fun community building event and just have fun with music and fellowship and, yeah.
Sounds great.
Yeah.
Kristen Price, thank you very much for coming in, and good luck with this endeavor, the first-time gospel workshop that you're putting on here in the capital city. Maybe there'll be more. Maybe you'll be back next year for the second annual. So,
maybe.
So good luck with it, and thanks for doing it.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right.
This is Bird Note. George Archibald has devoted his life to the conservation of cranes. As co-founder of the International Crane Foundation, he's worked for more than 40 years to understand and protect these stately birds. How did such fascination and commitment begin?
Since the age of 8, I'd been interested in the whooping crane because I heard a radio broadcast about the discovery of the nesting grounds. It was the CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation's School of the Air science program that we listened to in my one-room schoolhouse in Stillwater, Nova Scotia. And it was this drama of a male and female crane who'd flown the gauntlet to get 2,700 miles from Texas to their breeding ground. I never forgot it, and I read everything I could find as a child on whooping cranes. It led me to Cornell University to do my doctorate on the evolutionary relationships of cranes as revealed by their behavior. I wrote letters all over the world and asked for information about the cranes and came to the conclusion that very little was known about them and that if somebody didn't do something, we were going to lose many of the crane species.
Today, George Archibald and others are working to ensure that doesn't happen. To learn about their activities at the International Crane Foundation, begin at birdnote.org.
And I'd like to welcome into the studio Dr. Kathy Steppen. And it's Steppen, right?
Correct.
Well, welcome back. I know that you're here on occasion. Every now and then you're in the studio with kind of when you have a topic that you feel like talking about. And you're with Rainforest Pediatric Care, is that correct?
I am.
And so obviously you're a pediatrician. Is that
right.
Correct?
Right. And today I was hoping to talk about pediatric environmental health concerns.
Yeah. Well, why don't you go ahead and get started, and we'll see if I have questions. But I have a feeling you've got some information to pass along that's going to be of great interest.
I think it's interesting. I think that it's something I hope that all families are aware of. When I think about pediatric environmental health, I think about what kids are exposed to in their environment, in their air, soil, food, water, anything that they come in contact with that could have health repercussions for themselves, but then also for their eventual offspring. When we look at pediatric health issues, we know that it's not just the children who are here today. It's the developing fetuses, it's unborn babies that are still developing, that they can be exposed to environmental toxins that can affect their development and growth. And we can even go back further beyond that. And we know that parents, before they even conceive a child, if they have certain exposures, it puts their future offspring at risk. And then go back even one generation further, we know that grandparents' exposures affect grandchildren. Mm-hmm. So it's carried through the generations sometimes.
You had mentioned mold and air and water, soil, food. Real briefly touch on these things.
Sure.
What should people be thinking about or be aware of?
Right. All of those things, why it's so important for children is that their physiology is different than adults. For example, an infant breathes twice as fast as an adult does. So if they're breathing in diesel when they're standing next to a bus, for example, that's exhausting diesel fumes, then that infant is breathing in twice as much per at the amount that we are. So if it's bothering us, we know it's really bothering the infant. Young children in their first 6 months of life, for example, they drink 7 times the amount of water that adults do per body weight. Preschool children eat 5 times the amount of food adults do per body weight. So their exposures are so much greater for their size. And then we know that kids have unique exposures based on behavior. They maybe just want one particular food. For example, we know that the pesticides that are sprayed on grapes, all of them can't be washed off the skin of the grape. And so if a child's, despite trying to wash the grapes, if a child's eating grapes all the time, they're going to have exposure to that and probably more exposure than an adult would. So children are kind of unique. They might roll in the grass or get buried in the sand or whatever it is and are more likely to touch their mouths and ingest things through their skin or into their mouths than adults would. So when we think about all of the environmental exposures, children, because of their size and their physiology and their behaviors, have increased exposures compared to what adults do.
And is there an age range here that you're most concerned about or focused on? I mean,
there are, I think just in general, children of all ages, it's important because they have so many more decades to live. Mm-hmm. You know, being exposed to something when you're 5 means you have all those years to live versus when you're 85. It might have different effects in your body. So there's that longevity part of it that I think is important, but also children have different windows of development. For example, in utero, when the fetus is growing, the first 3 months are the stage of organ development and of where we really see that if there's an insult, if there's some type of environmental insult to the fetus at that stage, it's really a vulnerable period and can have lifelong repercussions. Same thing at different stages in childhood and even in adolescence and puberty, that there's these vulnerable windows that children go through as they're developing that we need to be aware of.
So, you know, people bring in their kids to the doctor and maybe they learn about this kind of information when they're having an interaction with their doctor. But, you know, outside of that, I mean, you're here to kind of raise awareness on this subject matter. So for people who are like, okay, I need to go online and learn more about this, I mean, are there some obvious places to go to just self-educate a little
right.
more?
There's some great resources, and it's unfortunate, but most of us in medicine don't get much education in how the things in our environment can affect our health. We get relatively little, and it's really a growing body of knowledge. So even if we learned something 5 or 10 years ago, there's always new things that we're learning. There's a great website called it's a great organization. It's a network of scientists and researchers and physicians, and that is called the Pediatric Environmental Health Specialty Unit. And there are 10 units across the country. Ours is Region 10. It includes the Pacific Northwest and Alaska. And if you can type in PEHSU.net, it will take you to the main site. And from there, you can go. There's wonderful information for both for doctors as well as for families to learn about what they can be doing in everyday life that will decrease risks.
And if somebody just failed to write that down, if they wanted to get a hold of you or give you a call to follow up on this kind of this information, do you have a phone number you could give?
Sure. They can always reach us at the office. Rainforest Pediatric Care is at 463-1210.
So we're kind of getting towards the end here. But on this, was there anything else on this topic that you wanted to make sure that you touched on today, or do you feel like you've kind of covered it?
The big things, I think that it's pretty easy for all of us to be a little bit concerned about what about these estrogen disruptors? What about different chemicals that we have in our plastics or our foods or our flame retardants, things like that that are in every one of us?
And we're surrounded by stuff.
We're surrounded by it, and I think it can be very concerning. And rather than being concerned and having that cause kind of a deer in the headlights paralysis, I really encourage families to get informed about it, because I think it's important to recognize that we can do some things. We can't do everything, but we can do some things, even something as simple as taking your shoes off at the door and leaving them so you're not tracking different contaminants into the house. Even something that simple can make a difference, and so I think it's important that families feel empowered to learn more and do what they can to limit exposures.
Dr. Kathy Steppen with Rainforest Pediatric Care, thank you for coming in. Thanks for the information. And again, if people wanted to get a hold of you just to follow up to either gain access to online information or just to talk with you, your phone number?
463-1210.
Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And the lovely guitar music we were just listening to is by Christy Lene. I'm going to take a guess. That's how you pronounce her last name. Christy Lene, who will be performing here in Juneau on July 24th at the Rockwell Ballroom. A Juneau Afternoon continues. Darren Snyder with the Juneau Cooperative Extension Service, district agent, correct?
Indeed, yes.
District agent Darren Snyder in the studio. It's always fun having you guys in here because you're always doing wonderful and fun things in the community to advance, in this case, would this fall under horticulture or agriculture or the garden tour? What are we talking about today?
Yeah, so we are talking about, I guess, technically horticulture, but growing in community gardens, which is very popular throughout the nation, throughout the state, and here in Juneau and Douglas.
So I think when people hear community garden, they think of the big one that's mm-hmm. out by Salmon. Where is it?
Montana Creek.
Thank you. Now, is that what we're talking about right now, or are you talking about other smaller community gardens that are around town?
All of the above.
Okay.
So these are community gardens is the focus of this tour that's coming up on Saturday, and it's going to be these different gardens have agreed to host us and are really excited to share about the gardens. There are about six of them participating. And it does include the kind of the grandfather Juneau Community Garden out there at Montana Creek, which was established in 1992, so 20-some years ago. Originally with that community garden, it was the vision to have other community gardens throughout Juneau and Douglas. But those folks who managed that one figured out that it was just enough to do that community garden project there. So there was quite a lull from 1992 on until we started creating new community gardens in town. And we established one, helped to establish one at Greening Park. So that Greening Park Community Garden is going to be part of this tour as well. Now, I think we got that going in 2006 or so. And then a community garden up in Star Hill, downtown Juneau, got started up buzz about 2010 and actually opening up around 2011 and serving those residents. And then we have a couple in Douglas, both at B Street there and also Crow Hill. And we've got these community gardens kind of around and about, including one. The other one downtown here is the Glory Hole. And that garden is a beautiful space.
Is it a rooftop garden?
Yes, rooftop, yeah. And the hill behind it. Yeah. And we just want community members to know that these community gardens exist, to learn a little bit about the uniqueness of each one. Some of them are open to the public for anybody to sign up for a plot. Some of them are open to specific populations of people. Each one of them is a group of gardeners who are rubbing elbows and learning what it is to garden together and just have a good productive fun pastime and good nutritious food to eat at the same time.
And how big are these? Do they range in size? I mean, I know the one out at Montana Creek's very large, but these other ones are smaller, I assume.
They are. The one in Montana Creek, they've got, I think they're up to 200 plots, and each one of those plots is 10 feet by 20 feet. So those are the big ones.
Yeah.
And one of the things we noticed is that, you know, they're way out there up in Montana Creek, up near the range, firing range and such, and so that's accessible by people who have transportation available to them through cars or live out in the valley a little bit closer. And so people have been, you know, asking and still do want to have a garden in their own neighborhood. And so that usually ends up with smaller land plots, such as Star Hill, which, if they're the same as I've am familiar with, they're about only 5 feet by 5 feet or thereabouts. And so you can do the square foot gardening techniques or just fit as much as you can in there without cramping those plants too much and still grow a good amount of food in that amount of space. But it's not all about the quantity of food. It's about, you know, growing together and just having a space of land to do that in.
So if somebody's going to do the tour, describe the tour a little bit. I mean, what is it they're going to do?
Good question. Being our first time doing this, we're probably going to make a few mistakes here. But the general
first times are always a lot of fun. They are.
Yeah. So we've got a flyer up on our website. If you go to Juno Cooperative Extension Service. And throw in Alaska there just in case they throw you to the other Juno in the nation. But Juno Cooperative Extension Service, and you can find there right on our homepage the flyer, which kind of gives you a basic description of the event. And then by the end of day tomorrow, we're going to have on there an information sheet, which includes kind of general information about how this is going to work, as well as what the different six or seven gardens are, and a brief bio on each of the gardens, give you a little bit of background, give you some contact information, and as well as what we're going to do for a map is to offer keywords, like for the Star Hill Community Garden, we're keying in into your own device, Chicken Yard Park, Juno, for example, and that will get you to where that garden is. And so we're not actually printing up maps. We're going to make you use your electronic devices to get there. But the big idea is that this is mostly self-guided. So between 10 a.m. and 1 p.m. on Saturday, this Saturday, you'll be invited to go to these gardens at whichever order you'd like. You could go to some of them or go to all of them. But each of the gardens will have a host, and so we'll have a little name tag that says garden host on it. So they'll be the one who's ready for your questions. If there are other gardeners around, we just ask that all of us as guests, as visitors, be respectful of the gardens, of course, and don't pick anything.
How about the slugs? Can you help remove slugs for people?
Probably so. Nobody's going to complain about
that. That would be the only thing.
Right, yeah. Only take slugs.
And the co-op's involvement with, I mean, have you helped get all of these gardens started? Do you have an ongoing involvement with the gardens, or how does that work?
I can honestly say that the Extension Service, the Cooperative Extension Service, has had its hands, our hands, in each one of these projects to some degree and another. Before I was on as the Extension Agent, people still remember Jim Douglas, and he was part of helping the Master Gardeners of Southeast Alaska get the original Juno Community Garden at Montana Creek started up. And so that was, again, back in 1992. And some of these gardens are established nonprofits. I'm actually sitting on the board as a resident of Douglas, of the Douglas Community Garden. So I'm kind of both the Extension Agent and a resident for that one. And so I'm on the board, and we've recently established as a nonprofit. And so each one's kind of organized differently. For example, the one at Greening Park is on the Alaska Housing Development Corporation property there at Greening Park, and it's specifically for Greening Park residents and or volunteers who want to come and help out. And each one kind of has its own purpose. That one's really got an educational bent to it, to help community members learn about gardening and help the kids, you know, have an experience there. The Glory Hole Community Garden is an excellent space for participants of that facility to go in and to have plots and to help raise vegetables there. I know that Maria Levischuk, the director there, her vision for that garden has always been to try and pair up in a way to have both community plots and resident plots at the Glory Hole Community Garden. I don't know if that's been realized yet, but that's part of her vision.
Lots to learn about here, but we got to wrap it up.
Yeah.
We could talk longer, I realize that. So just the headlines here about the event, and then we'll move along here.
Okay. So this is the Juno and Douglas Community Gardens Tour. For more information for the flyer for the information sheet, go to the Juno Cooperative Extension website and just Google that. And it's from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. on this Saturday.
Darren Snyder, always fun to have you in the studio, and sounds like a wonderful tour, and congratulations to all the gardeners as well.
Yeah, they're working hard.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Jamie.
First grade, you get a little paper cup, potting soil to fill it up. Teacher sends you home with a pumpkin seed. Put it in the window, warm and light. Give a little drink each and every night. Sunshine and water are all you need to grow your own. Grow your own. Soon you'll see the very first bloom from your own little farm in your own little room. Just grow your own. Diddly-diddle-i-diddle-iddle-do. 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 Just grow your own. A few years later in earth science class, clear a little corner of the high school grass, fence and trellis and rows of seeds. Chess team will come and measure the plants. Dance club will water them before they dance. Football team come and pull the weeds. Grow your own. Grow your own. Friends in the garden on bended knees, sprout like a bean or a sugar pea. Just grow your own. Diddly 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 do. Diddly 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 do.
And a big welcome to, I guess I would need to call you Maude Carousel, is that correct?
It's correct.
Okay, so we have Seneca Harper, who we just heard from, and I'm going to let you folks introduce yourselves.
I'm Paris Original.
And I'm Trojan Original.
And Seneca, welcome back. I understand that Maude Carousel has been in Juneau before, is that correct?
Yeah, we have. Thanks for welcoming us back. I think we've been here, what is this, our eighth year?
Seventh year.
So this is like an annual thing.
It is.
So where have I been? I've been missing out on this.
Yeah, you answer that.
So tell people, what is Maude Carousel?
Maude Carousel is a boylesque collective. We're an interdisciplinary cabaret troupe, and we tend to hire stellar performers from all around, mostly Seattle talent, and then bring them up here for an annual show. We do tours together. We've been all around Western Europe. We've been to Australia together, China one time. It's a lot of fun.
Boylesque. What is boy? I was thinking burlesque. So what's boylesque, or is it kind of the same thing but with a twist here?
Yeah, pretty much. It's just the male version of burlesque, which is pretty much the same.
And burlesque. What's burlesque for people who are curious?
I would say burlesque is comedic storytelling, usually. The celebration of glamour and the celebration of body with choreography, dance, and striptease and costume changes on stage.
So Maude Carousel, the three of you have been, are you Maude Carousel?
We are.
And how long have you been a group?
Oh. Since 2010?
Yeah.
Roughly since right before the first time we came here.
So the summer of 2009.
And how did it come to pass? What brought you guys together to produce Maude Carousel?
I was actually taking a burlesque workshop. I have a big dance and theater background, and I thought, well, this could be a fun little outlet. And I tried it, and I was blown away. So at the end of that, there was a performance opportunity, and it just kind of snowballed. You know, one producer asked me to be in a show, and then another producer asked me to be in a show. I was just about to come home to Juneau that summer, and I was invited by some belly dancers to be in their show. I was really, really nervous about it because I didn't know how Alaskans would respond to, you know, a man in a bar with all these fishermen performing burlesque. And I did, and they loved it. They absolutely loved it.
I'm not surprised.
So when I got home, I asked these guys, you know, they had started getting into burlesque around the same time, and I said to them, well, what if we put together a collective and we went up to Juneau and did a show? I think they would actually really like it.
So you're here. You have upcoming shows. So if somebody speak to the upcoming shows, when are they, and what should people expect who come to the shows? How are they going to be entertained?
Well, the first show is this weekend on Saturday at 7 and 10 p.m. It's called Fruitcake, kind of an homage to vintage, like 30s through 60s aesthetic and music and costuming and care to elaborate?
Well put. So, you know, Charleston, different types of swing
dancing.
Yeah,
so there's dancing and
jazz,
costume
blues.
Changes. Is it, you mentioned comedic earlier.
Yeah, both of these shows are pretty funny. Comedy tends to be our strong suit, and it's just enjoyable for everyone, you know. This show is, I think this is one of the funnier shows we've ever done. It's also really weird.
Yeah. In a good way?
In a good way.
In a very good way.
Yeah.
So is this... for all ages? Are there any, you know, cautions to the audience here?
Because we do remove our costumes, and it is in the Rockwell Ballroom, and we'll be serving alcohol at a bar, we're saying 21 and up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's not, I wouldn't say I would have to warn anyone. No one's going to be scarred for life
right.
by, you know, seeing us in our underwear. But I would say just come prepared with your dollar bills and prepare to be entertained.
How long is the show?
It's about 2 hours with intermission.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And do you have a band performing, or do you just have music supporting your acts, or?
Yeah, like each of us, we each get to pick our own songs, and that's kind of the magic of how this works. We have a completely creative control over it, and we don't have a live band. It's the way we've done it every other year with the solid songs that we pick, and we choreograph to it, and...
But we do, our MC will be singing live a couple times during the show. So there's that element of live music.
Yeah, and she's actually just about to release her first album. She is a really talented singer and performer, so we're excited to bring her up again.
Are you guys doing this full time? Are you working a day job and on top of that doing theater and creativity, things like this? Or, I mean, how does this fit? Is this a full-time gig?
I was full-time for quite a while, and now I do it full-time still, but I do have a day job right now as well. I'm kind of, you know, experimenting with what works and what doesn't work. It's difficult to have a day job that I can tell them, hey, I'm going to go to Europe for 6 weeks. I hope that's okay. I'll be back. Usually they
that
don't like that.
That would be a dream job. Yeah. Now, did you all have theater backgrounds, I mean, growing up, or, you know?
Trojan and I did. We started in theater and then moved into dance, and then that led to burlesque for us. So dance is our primary thing. Well, I guess now burlesque is our primary thing. Mm-hmm. But we have a very heavy dance background with theater behind that, too. So.
Yeah.
For me, it was the opposite. I started in dance and then became really involved in theater when I was a kid, and moved to Seattle to study theater in university, and then dropped out to become a scientist, and then dropped out to put on some sparkly shoes and travel the world.
It's an evolving career. I love it.
It is, yeah.
So we're going to have to wrap this up, but I would love to just go for have each of you something that would pique the curiosity of the audience. If people are thinking, oh, this sounds interesting, but I'm not sure I'm going to, you know, is there something you can just say about the show that you think might be a hook for somebody to say, I want to go see this. This is going to be fun.
I would like to say that probably the costumes, they're very creative, sometimes very literal, sometimes avant-garde, but very colorful, and something you don't see on television and something you definitely don't see on the street.
I think the most important thing to point out about this show, and even the show coming up though the next weekend, is that, like, we know you've seen us before, you know what we do, you know how fun it is, but we brought two completely new shows, almost entirely completely new material. So if you've seen us before, this is just another twist.
For me, I think just the comedy aspect, and it's unexpected comedy. Like, there are quite a few numbers that don't go quite the way you think they will when they start. So a little unexpected twists and turns in the show.
Sounds great. So, Seneca, one more time, just where's the first performance? What time?
This weekend's Maud Carousel show is called Fruitcake at 7 p.m. and 10 p.m. at the Rockwell Ballroom. Next weekend is called Mania, and that is July 22nd at 7 p.m. and then July 23rd at 7 p.m. and 10 p.m.
Well, I hope you guys have a great turnout, and I have no doubt you're going to enjoy the performances, and thanks for coming in. We've been speaking to Maud Carousel. Go see them, folks.
Thank you.
Right, thank you.
Thank you. This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We also rebroadcast